Welcome back, everybody. So we are in Mark's garage again this week.
It's noticeably colder.
It is noticeably colder. In fact, now we've gone through, well, you and I have gone through pretty much, you know, the range of seasons in the area.
It's true.
It was nice when it started. Then it was ball blisteringly hot. Is that a
ball blistering? Yeah, I think I got blisters on my balls.
Yeah, and then it
just seared the hair right off.
Yeah,
it's true.
It was bad, and then it melted to the seats, and then it was nice, and now it's fucking cold.
Yeah, it's like 35 degrees, which in Texas is fucking cold.
But we have cupcakes, so
that's true. Courtesy of our guest this week, Phil Ajerpu.
Thank you.
Thanks for joining us, Phil.
I'm glad to be here. I had so much fun last time. By the way, nice album pick last time.
Yeah, I wasn't even there to discuss it with you.
We should discuss it some other time.
We will.
Was it Loveless?
It was.
It was. Yeah. I was sick that week. So this
sick as fuck, I remember.
Yes, it was bad. But you still haven't done a show with the three original guys because Kevin is still
out.
Kevin's out on paternity leave.
Yes.
Cute kid, Kevin.
Cute kid, Kevin is. Yeah, his son not so much.
His son is actually quite adorable. I think.
No, he is a cute kid. Spent Thanksgiving with that little gentleman, and
what's his name?
He didn't say much. Miles. His name is Miles.
Kid name.
Yeah, Miles Carlton Newsom.
That sounds like a horror movie. Sorry, I just need to step back in here. If you saw a little baby, and somebody showed you their little baby, and like you just recoiled, like ooh. You couldn't even help the reflex,
the shudder,
enough to fake it.
I actually genuinely like my nephew, so we're all good on that front.
Okay, all right. Well, let's go ahead and let's rev this one up. Okay, guys,
let's do it.
What you got?
All right, I'm Shane.
I'm Ryan.
I'm Phil Ajerpu.
Hey, and I'm Mark.
And this is Somebody Likes It.
So now let's get a few interesting facts in musical history from Shane.
Oh, well, yes.
Well, it's current. It's current
it's
history.
Current.
Okay.
Well,
is it?
But in the future, it will be history.
I hope it's history. I hope this is his
Well,
defining
I have one
legacy.
Question for you, Shane. Will you take me higher?
I'm going to hit you in the head with this microphone.
Deserve that.
Yes. But Ryan is correct. What Mark was alluding to is that I wanted to talk this week discuss some current events again. And
a Florida luminary, if you will.
Yes. Scott Stapp, the former singer from Creed?
Creed.
I tried to
Creed.
Block it out of my head.
Yeah. Crap? Wait, no. Creed?
Writers and performers of some of the worst butt rock.
They are responsible for Nickelback.
I was going to say for Nickelback, maybe the worst band.
Really, they're responsible
for... They've eclipsed them in shittiness,
really do
too.
I know how they're responsible for Nickelback, though.
Well, okay, it's like, really, like, if you go back far enough, I say you blame Eddie Vedder. But Pearl Jam's all right in my book.
Well, maybe. I mean, you can blame Eddie Vedder with the rumbly, grumbly vocals
Right. But
I mean,
Scott Stapp is the point where Mad at Your Dad Rock really got constipated.
He's the kind of guy that did and does, I'm sure now, I'm sure in his rider, one of the things they had to have on stage, they towed it around fans so he could lean into the fans and have his hair beautifully blown back.
Well, and he was always oiled up
too.
Yeah, like, and yes. So Scott Stapp
is so insufferable that he makes Bono look okay.
It's a different kind of insufferable, but yeah, there's also some God pontificating there. Last weekend, he posted a video on Facebook, which apparently you can't. I've seen part of it, and it's insane and amazing on Facebook. And in it, he talks about how it goes on for about 15 minutes, and the first 5 minutes of it, it's just him saying, and every other thing he's pausing, and he's just obviously he's fucked up. And he's saying that people have been accusing him of not being sober, but he is completely sober. And then goes on to say that the banks have colluded to take all of his money. Colluded with the FBI, I believe.
That's perfectly rational.
Yeah, and he's homeless, broke, and he was living in his truck. But as of that time, he was living in a Holiday Inn, but wasn't using drugs at all. And his wife filed for divorce. And I got a hold of some of the text messages that well part of the evidence that she's using in her divorce claim or whatever. She's saying that he's been doing so many amphetamines, crystal meth, and steroids that he's become completely paranoid. And here are a few of the text messages I'm going to read for you guys for your enjoyment.
Please do.
Cannot wait.
Okay, here's one. Florida is not safe. Biological weapons on the way. You have to leave with kids and meet me in Atlanta.
That sounds about right.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
I lived in Florida for a year, my first year teaching, and he's right.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I'm starting with the most believable in going down.
Move down.
I'm coming to get you, Satan and children. No mercy. You know how this ends. God created you, and now God is ending you. Okay. Then we start getting...
It's alarming.
Wells Fargo working out my account problems. Haven't eaten all day. I'm asking if they can spot me $1,000 so I don't fall over from malnutrition. And then we start
Wells Fargo, let's work with the guy here.
Because I think $1,000 is about my daily dietary budget.
That's reasonable for Wells Fargo to front the guy.
Well, I'm glad that they're working out his account problems too, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, because they apparently have been in collusion with the FBI or some other thing.
It makes me really glad I don't use Wells Fargo.
Well, you're right. You know, I hadn't even considered that before.
Scott
right.
Stapp is really a wizened sage. Let's all just acknowledge
he looks
that.
Pretty fucking wizened if you look at this video. There's something going on. All right, I'll read two more, and then we'll get out of this and go on to this week's records. Okay, God is telling me something about Palm Springs and Nashville, so there's a connection somehow. He's also telling me DEA for some reason. That's a sober man. And then the last one, I wouldn't doubt if the CIA is behind Alcoholics Anonymous.
I wouldn't
doubt
it.
And these are text messages or
tweets? These are text messages that his estranged wife, Jacqueline, included in her divorce petition.
How trustworthy is she?
She married Scott Stapp.
That's what I'm saying.
That's a good point, but you've got to think that it's easy to find the genesis, you know, of the messages. And then I'm sure that she saved them on her phone. I mean, I think it's probably pretty easily trackable. But yeah.
I'm sure they're real.
What are those grounds for divorce at that point? Is it just he's batshit insane?
I think that is the legal definition.
Yes, okay. Batshit insane. Oh, anyway, so I just, you know, I have, I guess in summation, I have as Scott Stapp was famously described by David Cross, he's an asshole. And he's done a lot of bad things to the world. And
didn't they like play poker together? Or something at one point.
Yeah. Thanks for the words, man. so anyway, I don't really wish.
I mean, I don't wish ill on anybody. Like, am I the only one here who's been divorced? Anybody else?
No, not that I'm aware of.
No,
you've been divorced.
No,
you haven't. So I'm the only one. I wouldn't wish it on my worst enemy.
No, I don't wish. No. I don't wish ill. On anyone, however,
I am
going to delight
machine.
In the Schadenfreude of this.
Yeah, I mean, like Creed released some really shitty music upon the world.
Oh my god! Like, what about
and
that
this
song
may be
where he's
chickens
like,
coming home to roost?
I'm 6 feet from the edge.
We don't need to be discussing Creed lyrics. Stop! I can see you trying to think of them, and let's why don't we get on to something that's better than that?
I don't wish divorce on him. I do wish for a time machine so I could stop him.
Let's focus on the drug.
Most people
want to
go back and kill Hitler. You want to go back and stop Scott Stapp.
Yeah.
I think priorities. They're both worthy causes.
Oh, no. I totally agree.
Agreed. It's just like, you know, let's not go so far back. It's like if I go back to 1998?
Something like
97?
That, yeah.
Yeah, I think that's
right.
About right.
Yeah, you know, if something goes horribly wrong, I'm not that far from where I already am. If I go back to, you know, the 30s.
Okay.
As a colored man.
So whose selection is this week's record, Shane?
This is mine.
Why don't you tell us about it?
So this is Shane's record.
Well, I picked this record because, well, number one, like, I had been aware of some songs on this for a long time, but not aware of the we can get to this in a minute. I think the album cover is one of the coolest fucking album covers ever. And I've seen the vinyl like all over the place with the little splotches of color and stuff. So, oh, by the way, it's a Shuggie Otis inspiration information. That's,
I love this album.
Yeah, I do too. I loved it. I fucking loved it. This is, I was patting myself on the back. This, in my mind, absolved me of any lingering guilt that I had for picking Slippery When Wet a few months ago.
The jury's still out.
But yeah, so I wasn't. I was sort of knew what I was going to get into, and then in the first song, it's just so, it just sucked me in. It's all these elements of, you know, it was in the mid 70s. When was it?
74.
So 74. That's what I thought.
19 when it came out.
Yeah, which is crazy. Yeah,
and it was his third, maybe fourth album. Depending.
It was his third album, but it took him 3 years to do
it. Depending on which sources you cite. So, like, Stephen Thomas Erlewine from AllMusic said it was his fourth. And I'm like, and I've been a fan of Shuggie Otis for, like, over a decade. I'm like, fourth album? And I trust Stephen a lot. I'm like, I better look at this. So I go and click the discography tab. Only three albums. I go back into the biography, and there's a link to an album before those three albums, which is on, it's on RDO. So I went and listened to it today.
And is that one of his dad's albums that he was on? Or?
No, okay. So his dad, like, and that's the thing that's really, really weird with history and, like, some of these lost albums and, like, how the internet has opened up, you know, access to some of these things. It's like, so, yeah, I knew Inspiration Information really, really well, and I knew Freedom Flight. Those are my two jams. And then, like, there was the album before that. It's like, here comes Shuggie Otis, right? But there's an album before that where Al Cooper from Blood, Sweat, and Tears, and he, when he was 15, end up recording a whole album, 7 tracks, in New York over a weekend.
And it's just like floating out there that nobody knows anything about it. You know, this kid was obviously a fucking prodigy.
Started playing when he was 2.
Yeah, I've read that. 2 years old.
But like, when you're the son of Johnny Otis, what else?
I could barely wipe my ass when I was 2 years old.
Well, I love the. It's amazing to me also that it took him 3 years to complete this record, and for a lot of different reasons. But I mean, a lot of times you'll see a tortured artist, especially in this taking 3 years to complete an album,
especially back then.
And that's what I'm saying. In the 70s,
well,
now,
no, and they expect you to pump them out,
right?
They want to develop you as an artist,
yeah.
And so this was something that I noticed in his backstory that he was just kind of like, I'll get to it. Billy Preston, no less, asked him to come tour with him with the Stones.
And he's like, nah,
no thanks.
Yeah, I read that.
No, I'm
thanks.
Good.
I'm taking some time off.
Who does that?
I think I'm going to retire
Shuggie
at 19.
Otis.
Yeah.
I think, well, you know, one of the things, there's so much to say about it. It was amazing because
he spent more time not being a musician.
I want to know what he was doing.
Well, what I'm thinking is,
oh, right. Yeah.
There might have been a bit of that.
There's probably a little bit of that going on. But, I mean, I mean,
like, inspiration, lack of motivation. Like, he's
inhalation.
Good, but, like, you know, just...
Inspiration, inhalation. Like
inspiration, inhalation, yeah.
I thought that and you start out with the first song on this, and this is one thing I want to pull it back just a minute to this particular record. There are elements of this that I can see in so much stuff that came after it. It's amazing to me. I can hear Prince being influenced
by this. Well, I definitely think...
Steely Dan.
What is that Lenny Kravitz song, It Ain't Over Till It's Over? Direct descendant.
Oh, yeah. Lenny Kravitz is definitely... There's no way... But the thing is that for me, like, a lot of the musicians that I'm just talking about are not my favorite musicians, and there are elements of this record in a lot of different disparate kinds of music, not necessarily disparate, but you know what I'm saying, like a lot of different genres of music,
yeah.
Right, that I don't necessarily love. But for some reason, the way this is all put together, the alchemy of it, I just fucking bought. I ate it up. I loved it.
It flows like an album. Also, here's the original cover, first pressing.
Oh, right. Wow. Well, that's not the one I was talking about.
Right.
That's,
so the one that you have is the one that...
The
Luwaka Bop one?
Yeah. David Byrne,
yeah,
2001.
Byrne.
Well, that's when I became aware of of this, you know, was seeing that on vinyl in record stores.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, it's so eye-catching. It's so cool.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Why don't we get into the first track? I would imagine that's
certainly,
the one.
Certainly, because I think that's the one that really
kicks
it all off, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Let's listen to that. Inspiration Information.
get a purple stain. Called Keeping Is in Tune. Beside the whistle can.
I hear a lot of Bobby Womack in there.
I didn't even think about that. You mentioned that in the break.
Well, and what to me, Bill Withers.
I agree with that wholeheartedly,
too. Bill Withers with a stiffy. You know, like, this, I mean, let's be honest, kids. This is baby making music, and
he'd already made babies by then.
That's true.
Really,
he had. Father.
And that's part of the thing, though, for me. And I had never heard this album before, but I have heard this music before. But for me, it's trying to figure out like
where,
what are the influences,
yeah,
and what has been influenced, you know.
So what
like
I wrote,
where does this fall within?
I mean,
that
a lot of people
these,
have sampled
all these artists. I feel that, all these artists that we're pulling out.
Yeah.
So what like, I wrote down, and you guys correct me if I'm wrong, but I put Bill Withers with a stiffy meets James Brown on Quaaludes with a dash of Sly and the Family Stone.
Okay, so
where's the hot tub?
I think the thing that everybody thinks about when they talk about like Shuggy Otis is that child prodigy, guitar. They mentioned Strawberry Letter 23, which the Brothers Johnson covered, which is how I found out about Shuggy Otis, because I was a huge fan of Louis Johnson's bass playing. And so I followed the rabbit hole backwards.
I don't even know if I've heard that song before.
Oh, it's a great song. And, I mean, if you listen to it, you'll be like, I mean, a lot of people have been like, oh, I know this song.
Yeah, yeah.
It's kind of like you mention a band like Big Star, and people are like, I don't know Big Star. And you're like, oh, the theme song from that 70s show. And everyone's like, oh, that's Big Star?
Yeah,
well,
yeah,
it's
yeah,
Cheap Trick
right.
Ring Big Star. But you've heard it.
That's what I assumed.
Right, so if you hear the Brothers Johnson cover Strawberry Letter 23, you'll be like,
oh, yeah, I've
definitely heard this in like
it's just such
the supermarket or something.
Title.
Oh, but the groove is unstoppable. It's about his girlfriend writing notes to him on strawberry scented paper. So that was on strawberry paper. And it was
I remember those
letter.
Days.
Right.
It
so
makes more sense.
I think the fact that he's a guitarist. Super, super important, and that's why I hear like a lot of Bobby Womack, because Bobby Womack was originally a guitar slinger for like Sam Cooke and the Valentinos before he stepped out, you know, solo.
Oh, I can hear, I can completely hear that. We were talking, like you were saying, like who is he influenced by and who did he influence? Like it's sort of hard to parcel out.
There's so many components.
Right, but you can definitely hear you. I think that I can see a direct line from him to a lot of artists that were current and that came later. Like we were talking about Prince. I mean, like, without a doubt, there's no way that he had. That
no,
he
Prince
had,
was very aware.
Yeah, yeah.
Lenny Kravitz very aware.
Yeah, right, and a lot of different people. Did you, by the way, did you guys happen to see? So we're over here basically. You know, sucking a dick of inspiration information. I mean, like, I think we're all pretty much
everyone likes it.
Like, well, okay, I like it. I don't love it as much as you guys do, and it kind of made me tired. And I know that it was supposed to make me horny, because I think that's kind of like the gist of like this is. I mean, when I say it's baby making music,
like I
totally felt like I don't know how many kids were conceived to this record, but it was a bunch.
No. Can I want to push pause here for a second. These guys haven't been around for this. I want to go back and see how many fucking of these podcasts. How many times? Like these are the two. This is like the spectrum for you of how of the unless it's something you pick. Like something that one of the other one of us pick, it either makes you tired, or and then you reference like there's some sexual reference in there. That those are like that's the spectrum. But usually shit makes you tired. And then
then there was Meatloaf.
Meatloaf, I had a particular vitriol for.
All of us did. I'm so glad I missed that one. In the garage
that
day.
You are glad you missed
but
that one.
I just want to point one thing out, Ryan, and these guys don't know you as well as I do. Every time you say, this music kind of made me feel tired. Yeah, dude, because you're listening to it at 4:30 in the fucking morning.
Oh, no, I was listening to it in the car. Like, when I wasn't tired, and then while listening to it, got tired.
So that, and didn't Janet Jackson's Control make the same thing happen to you? You're listening to the car, and then
I just got bored.
No, you had a whole conversation about how the guy you were with. Anyway, we'll get
roommate
we'll get
or whatever. The
tempos on the album.
True. That did happen one other time. You're right.
It's happened more than one other time. Okay. Anyway, I just want to point that out. But so we'll get off that.
As opposed to Janet Jackson's Control, this does have slower tempos.
And they're all
the
same.
And a more languid sort of feel to it.
And yet, what's the runtime on the actual album? Not the reissue that's got the four extra tracks, but like...
I think it's nine tracks total.
It ends with...
It's like 40-some-odd minutes. It's...
Yeah, so that's at the upper limits for me, but I feel like it flows by. Again, it's like kind of like Loveless, where that's 52 minutes, but it flows by because it's all kind of like... It hypnotizes you. I do agree. It's very hypnotic. It does what it's supposed to do, you know?
I just feel like I needed to be on a bearskin rug and
it's
a pussy fireplace.
I didn't I didn't hear that at all. I mean, I get it now that you're saying that.
Do you not notice that? It almost sounds like porn music from the 70s.
in no way entered my head. It's just I'm just bobbing my head and like cleaning my house and shit. Like,
it's mood music.
This could be
mood music.
You turn the lights down a little bit.
No, if I put this shit on and I'm trying to seduce somebody and I put on I'm just gonna be snickering.
As long as you get your stuff done by like track six or so.
It starts. Yeah, the album definitely peters out. We'll get
track five, Happy House, and then
I think that certain albums for me are like certain times of the day, and I talked about this with Loveless. Like, it was weird to listen to it in broad daylight. Like, that's a nighttime album. To me, this is like, this album is way better at night than like in the broad light of day. You know, it's not a. I think the reason that it was forgotten and then rediscovered is twofold. One, Shuggy Otis was the original Slick Rick and disappeared. Two.
Yeah.
On top of that, it's like there were a lot of really, really good albums back then that are in the same genre that are actually better albums. It's not that this isn't a bad album. It's a good album. And I think it's...
Yeah, I think it got to like maybe number 56 on the R&B charts and barely cracked the top 200.
Right. Where the previous album had a lot of strength based on the Brothers Johnson cover. So that's the thing. It's like... I mean, you could say, it's a really great album for a third album from a 19-year-old, and you'd be right. I think a lot of people go back, and they're, like, itching to find out whatever genre. It's like, I think that happens with a lot of music listeners. You listen to the music that's current when you're a kid that you find, and you're like, this is my music. It's not my parents' music. It's not my brother's music. It's my music.
And you want to find out what influenced them.
Right, and then you follow the rabbit hole down.
Underground.
Right, and so you chase down the rabbit hole, and maybe you're like, you know what, I kind of like this genre. Like, for me, it was power pop. So I went down the power pop rabbit hole, and not a lot of people are releasing that stuff now. So I had to go to the 70s, and once I got there, I was like just dying. I'm like, oh, man, I wish I could find more stuff. So you just start finding the stuff that just isn't as classic, but you love it because you have a predisposition for that genre. So if you like 70s funk R&B, this is a great place to keep digging because it's better than a lot of current stuff that kind of tries to mine the same vein.
I mean, I get what you're saying completely. I don't necessarily have a super soft spot for that, and that's why I felt like, for me, for whatever, there was a convergence of the right elements. It's not a classic album only because it peters out toward the end. But the first few tracks on it, I mean, it's...
I'm with you on that.
Spectacular.
You know, I get up to about the second, well, the third track, really, and then the fourth track. And for me, I start to really kind of understand a lot of what was influencing me when I was making music 20 years ago. And things that I never really understood. You know, I laid them down to some resurgence bands and stuff. But here I'm hearing, like, a wah-wah pedal and a flanger and a chorus all melded into one. A
lot of Hendrix in him, too.
Oh,
well,
yeah.
Sure. And from what I've read, Hendrix actually borrowed a lot of that from him as well.
Uh-huh.
Like, there was a lot of this push and pull back and forth.
Right, because he was tracking as a session guitarist in the 60s.
Right. I mean, it's interesting to... I guess that's the main thing, and that's kind of like a recurrent theme here today that we keep going back to the fact that, number one, what if, what could have been, how young he was, and how influential he was.
I mean, he was doing Prince younger than Prince was doing Prince. Earlier than Prince was doing Prince. Prince was 17 when that first album was released.
That was the thing, you know, that was amazing to me. When the first thing I kept, like, the deeper we got into this, or the deeper I got into this record, the more and more I kept going, like, motherfucker, this sounds like Prince. And it further along you get in the record.
Well, did any of you guys get did anybody have a read on why he dropped out of the scene?
I'm gonna guess because he could.
I'm gonna tell you this.
Let me ask you guys this. No, I know. Sorry to cut you off. Would you guys say that he's the J.D. Salinger of smooth R&B funk?
If ever there was one.
Yeah, I mean, if you would say that, you know, Slick Rick is the J.D. Salinger of 80s hip-hop, sure.
You're blowing my fucking mind.
That's right, man.
Whoa, dude, I feel like Shuggie Otis must have filled the mid-70s right now.
Goddamn right, man.
All right, let me just read you a couple of things. Like, this might give you a little bit of an insight to what was going on 40 years ago. Okay. So, this is the official Shuggie Otis website, ShuggieOtisMusic.com. So one would assume that they would know what's going on, like what the facts were. All right, so Shuggie Otis' first ever live album, and this posting came out in the middle of September of this year. This show was recorded at Brooklyn's Music Hall of Williamsburg on April 19, 2013, as part of his recent comeback tour. Then it goes on to, like, detail the personnel that night. And then parenthetically it says, his son Lucky is also played in the band, although it seems he wasn't involved in this particular show.
It seems?
It seems?
Wouldn't you know?
Wouldn't you know?
You're ShuggieOtis.com.
Happenstance shows that.
Okay, remember I said we'll give you a little insight into why he disappeared 40 years ago. It's the inhalation inspiration. and here's another. This is my other favorite thing on this website. That's golden right there.
That's pretty
this
great.
Was pretty good, too. Tour dates. Nothing yet, period.
Wait, isn't he on some supposedly like never-ending tour now?
I don't know. I'm not sure. I think last year he went out on tour.
Yeah. But, man, we don't have anything but I yet, just, man.
love the way they put that. Nothing yet, period.
Not even an ellipsis?
His son, Lucky, may or may not have played that night. I mean, all sides point to he did.
Who knows, man?
I don't even know about that. Life. Was I even there that night? So, anyway, that's a little bit of insight. All right, why don't we play another song?
Which one are you going to do?
I liked the second track. I don't know what
like
you guys were thinking.
I like Out of My Head, too.
Out of My Head is my second favorite.
Yeah, so. I would agree, too.
Yeah, let's do Out of My Head. I love, by the way, here's another, before we do this, you made a comparison to Sly and the Family Stone earlier, and this has got like a weird, like phonetic spelling.
That is true.
Like, just like, thank you for letting me be myself.
Yeah. Yep.
So, I mean, there's mice like all elf. Mice yeah. elf. Yeah. Yeah.
Mice elf.
Like the plural of a mouse. Yes.
Right.
And then elf.
The singular
like
of elf.
That
like Will
kind
Ferrell.
Of dude that works for Santa Claus.
Elf right. on the shelf.
Yeah, that's right. We were talking about that.
We have an elf on the shelf, which apparently is a new holiday tradition, right. Which Mark will tell us about later.
I thought you were walking when you walked in with the elf on the shelf earlier. I thought it was like he's like, "Have you guys seen this?" And from far away, it looked like a little Pinocchio doll. And I was like, "Are you? Is this like an obscene Pinocchio thing?" Or I couldn't really.
You guys always you got to turn it to the sex stuff
to the dark
you?
Side.
That's right, man.
Why don't we bring it back and listen to this track?
All right, yeah, Out of My Head.
Love. the bed for a ride.
Still look at the song title for this one and see I hurt my head.
Well, it's phonetic.
It is phonetic, but this is a great song, and I was while we were listening to it, I kind of asked the question as to like bands like Bee Gees and such, you know, where do they fall within this timeline of influence and influencer.
Well, as I understand it, the Bee Gees originally were like a really
signed by Apple
poppy,
Records.
Well, and yeah. Phil pointed this out, signed by the Beatles, Apple Records.
Yeah.
And they were a really poppy band.
Very.
But by the late 70s, they kind of had this disco butt thing going on, which I can definitely see as descending from this gentleman here.
And my point being
ending,
that,
by the way.
Yeah, disco and my point being thing. Exactly this feels kind of like the petri dish of disco.
No, I'm with you on that. You know, like just that.
Yeah, a lot of early 70s funk is, especially, I think the thing that pushes it over the edge a little closer to that is that cool ass like drum machine that sounds like it's straight off the organ.
Yeah.
Which also sounds like.
You know what? It sounds like a better, cooler version of when you're a kid and you get your first like little Casio keyboard.
Yeah, dude. Yeah.
Did we all have one of those?
Yeah, we did. Yeah.
It's like, and you get all. I remember when I was a kid and I had one of those things, and I was like going through all the preset.
Yep.
All the preset rhythms.
Is that where your Bossa Nova love comes from?
No, but I was always confused by what boss, because it was like marching. It was like march, foxtrot. Waltz. I knew what all these things were. There's right. Like bossa nova, and I was like, "What is that?" Anyway, do you guys like the way that I emulated?
That yeah, and that's basically the beat of the song.
I remind myself.
I'm going to sample that from this podcast.
You should. What was the cat's name that was in the Police Academy movies?
Because he was also in Spaceballs.
Michael Winslow should learn from me now.
We got the bleeps, the sweeps, and the creeps.
I'm taking it to the next level. Down. It's like David Blaine and David Copperfield, how David Blaine, like, you know.
We were talking about a record once.
David oh, I know. Blainerfield.
Right. Sorry about that.
So, anyhow, out of my head.
Out of my head.
Yeah, it was good. I mean, that's my. I love
I
that
dig
song.
It. No, I dig it.
Yeah. Wait, you were saying something, Mark.
Okay.
About the previous track.
Well,
and this will come up many times as long as I'm involved in this podcast. This obsessive compulsive nature of mine, and the musician in me noticing things like this. But he goes flat in this song.
Yes, unquestionably, twice.
At
I think
twice.
Intentionally.
Yeah.
Because it's true, like, but it no, doesn't really
and
bother
you say,
me that
I
much.
Think intentionally. And,
I think intentionally.
And that really interests me.
He has, I mean, it took him 3 years to make the album. You listen to his previous albums. It's like, clearly the guy can sing in tune and take the time to sing in tune at a time when autotune didn't exist. You know, is he a strong singer? No, but he was, you know, 15 when he started singing, and he'd been playing guitar for the previous 13 years. Think about that. How many guitarists step out of the guitar slinger thing, step into singing, and get as confident with their singing as they get with their guitar, plus the whole voice change puberty thing?
Can I just take just a real quick second?
That is a good point.
This is something that does get on me, and I've been noticing this a lot lately, is this two-year-old progeny guitar playing type of thing. I have a two-and-a-half-year-old in my household, and that kid, he's extremely talented, and he can pick up that little dog guitar that he's got.
Yeah,
and he can certainly do a good air guitar. But I mean, like, can you really start playing guitar at 2 years old?
Man, there are kids who are playing violin at one,
and we call them Asians.
If you beat your children,
but they can
do amazing things.
So Shuggy apparently started playing guitar at 2 years old.
Which makes total sense, because his dad was, you know, Johnny Otis. He was in a musical family. What else is he going
to
do?
There's a genetic component to, I mean, let's
it's like,
you
know, like, well, I don't know about that. I mean, maybe. I think it's more environment than it is genetics. I think music.
We can go down the nature versus nurture.
I just don't want to get all, like, Nazi on this shit and start breeding musicians or something.
No, I'm not talking about
eugenics. Where did I come from?
I'm just saying that if your father is a brilliant musician, there's at least a decent
but
chance.
But I know plenty of musicians.
What is that definition of playing guitar at 2 years old?
Well, that's
it. Probably
ridiculous.
Means that there was a guitar that he gave him a guitar, and then he was legitimately starting to take lessons. I mean, look, Mozart was playing piano, and Mozart was composing by five
symphonies.
So
these things.
But his dad was a court violinist.
They're not common
environment,
which is why they're remarkable.
Right. You know, there's like
prodigy is a prodigy, but that, I don't think that's I honestly think that's not
I think it's
there.
Kind of brave that he made the choice to kind of bend that note expressively and blue, because does he know how to play guitar? Clearly he knows how to play guitar.
Sure.
Clearly he is not a Buster Ass musician. Right? He knows
a Buster
right
Buster Ass?
Yeah.
I don't know what that is.
And I think like, that, Buster I think, Ass is that, even more
is that
so
Hindi?
No.
Is that Chicago?
Maybe. Buster ass motherfucker.
That, no, I just that, don't actually that, know if that's positive
it's
or negative.
It's not, it's negative.
Okay.
Is that Southern continent or whatever you called it?
The subcontinent, yes.
Hey,
subcontinent.
Anyhow,
we have a lot to talk, a lot more to talk about this, but it's
I think, I think he owns those out of tune notes, and I think he just bends them blue.
Really?
Yeah.
And that.
They don't bother me nearly
even more
as much.
So,
I think it fits in the moodiness of the song.
Even more so, that gets to me. But
as a choir teacher, I can tell you about a lot of things that piss me off intonation-wise, but that doesn't.
Okay. But I mean, that comes back to matters of personal taste. I mean,
it is
If you think back, like if Ryan thinks back to when I got quite agitated about Courtney Love's propensity or off-key
singing.
Yeah,
but I'm kind of with you on that.
Yeah, but a lot
but
of
she
people
does it for
like that.
Affectation.
That's what I'm saying. That's and exactly what Phil is saying. He's doing it for
maybe
affectation.
Maybe that's the best she can do, though.
Yeah.
If she does or not, but what I'm all
she owns
all
it.
I'm saying, it doesn't matter if she... Oh, I hated it. A lot of people like it. It's just a matter of... It
taste,
comes down to a matter of taste at some point.
But she does
so
it as a kind of rote thing where she ends every phrase.
This is not a...
Anyway.
This is not a kangaroo court about
Courtney Love.
What I get from it is that...
Yeah.
This is almost a pun in his sense because he is out of his head, and that flat tone really kind of plays into that whole out of my head.
So does that mean you like it, dislike it?
I don't know.
Yeah. But the album's new for you?
Maybe hearing you discuss it that way is leaning me a little bit more towards liking it, but yeah, it's still my OCD kind of says, no, he's flat.
Oh, yeah, no, like originally I felt the same way too, I think, but that was like a decade ago.
So, Shane, we have other business at hand, I think.
Yeah, let's take an intermission here. We've got a song.
It's true.
We've got a song.
Is that what they call it?
We're going to go ahead and watch the video right now and together.
Are we introducing this first, or are we doing it after the...
Sure, no. Ryan, you picked it this week to say what we're going to do, and we'll talk about it in a minute.
Tell them what we're going to watch here.
A little mini masterpiece by one Gwen Stefani called Holla Back Girl.
Amazing.
Okay, we'll talk about it in a minute.
I'm just going to say, I've never actually heard the song.
You've never heard it in your life?
No.
Oh, you're in for a treat.
Never once.
Not once.
All right, well... Put a cork in that, and we'll talk about it in a second.
Well, I'm going to judge it ahead of time and say the best thing she ever did was Tony Kanell.
Oh, Jesus Christ.
Yes.
All right, kids.
I wish you would have taken my advice when I said put a cork in it.
Dadheads represent.
We had a cork here, too.
So this week's A Few Minutes With, I take full responsibility for, which it looks like I'm going to be the lone wolf on this one. I genuinely love this song, Holla Back Girl.
Love?
I like it a ton.
Wait. Love or like a ton?
I'm in the, 80, 90% range here. Like, I really like it a lot.
Go on.
I didn't know about this song when it came out, which it turns out it came out about 10 years ago, 2004. And I saw like a clip of an old Saturday Night Live on like VH1 or something where she was performing this live, and I'm like, what the fuck is that? And it may be that I just have a propensity to really love pop songs that have marching bands in them, because I also love Tusk by Fleetwood Mac.
I do love Tusk.
It's a fantastic song. And so my sample size is only two, but
I can't
so far,
believe we're
man,
comparing...
they're back 1,000 on these songs with marching bands in them. But I genuinely... really like this song.
If you like ham, you might
times.
Like spam.
Now, I don't think it's good necessarily in like the classic like art sense, and certainly, like, you guys were all talking during, like, we actually just watched the clip.
We did. And, I've never seen the song ever in my life.
Everybody's like, what the fuck is this song about? And I had the same vexing conundrum as well. And I finally went back and actually read the lyrics.
Oh, jeez.
And so I have kind of broken it down.
Wait, there are lyrics?
There are lyrics to it. It turns out it's about, like, basically some girl stepping to her. And her,
okay,
like...
So tell me, please, Ryan, what is a holler back girl?
Well, I'm still unclear on what a holler back girl is.
Holler back girl
is...
Can we Urban Dictionary that?
You know, that's not a bad idea.
Okay,
Shane,
well, you keep talking. Well,
Shane,
yeah.
Shane's going to get on that while we
Well, okay,
talking.
So a couple things. I did a shit tally. Because the thing that I noticed when I chose it, and I already knew I liked this song, but I guess I'd never heard the uncensored version. So when I pulled it up on Spotify, I was like, man, she sure does say shit a whole lot in this song. And I sat down tonight before I came over, and I actually did a little... You know, like
shit tally.
An actual shit tally where you make your hash marks.
38
times. And I also did a little math. This song is 3 minutes and 20 seconds long, so...
That's a shit every...
Shit occurs approximately once every 5.26 seconds.
It's a lot of shit.
That's way good. More than the words holla back or girl. Shane, you have any news?
I do have news. But I before we get to that, like... I don't want to disparage in any way your appreciation of this song. In fact, that's one of the things that I most treasure in of the show is our
I'm gonna tear up, man.
Diversity in musical taste. We on the other side. So on the way that the table is shaped up tonight is that Mark and Phil are on one side, and their temporary adversaries, Ryan and Shane, are on the other. But I don't like this song, but I do think it's really innovative, and I'll tell you why. You asked me why during the video. It's really interesting. There is incredibly little use of melody at all. It's almost entirely rhythmic, and the way that the rhythms are used sometimes, like, it's a very... Like, a marching band makes sense because the rhythm is – it's a very constant rhythm. But then there will be, like – I mean, every so often, like, a guitar
Yeah,
line
just that
comes
little
in,
lilting guitar line right in the middle of it,
just
that
come in.
Accent.
And basically, the whole thing, it makes sense that there are cheerleaders in it as well because it sort of sounds like a cheer, you know? Like,
well, they do that bananas thing, which is for us – it's a fucking summer camp cheer.
Sure. I mean, but I'm not talking about that part of the song. I'm talking about the production values of the song.
Do you have a problem with bananas, Phil?
No, they're delicious and a great source of potassium.
It's not.
It's true.
A wonderful
this
phallic
shit is
symbol.
Bananas.
It's a pop song.
It's a pop song, and it doesn't sound like any other pop song.
Okay, well, I mean, that's definitely your opinion of it. I mean, but it's innovative. I think that it's really innovative in the sense that when you usually see if one were to take. It harkens back in a lot of ways to really early rap where there's no melody at all. It's just there's just beats in there. It sounded like nothing that was on the radio at the time.
Early rap had tons of melody in there too.
We're not talking about.
Well, not all of it though.
This is a much longer discussion that we're going to get
to.
Weirdly, like I just a couple days ago listened to "Dumb Girl" by Run DMC.
Yeah,
there's no melody in that song.
It's dumb girl,
but it's a good song.
Hey, that was
and
melody
this hits
right
me
there.
In the same kind of way. Like it's not, this ain't genius. Like
it's definitely not genius.
You know, like art. However, it is innovative, and it hits me somewhere where I live.
I gotta tell you my impression when this song came out, and I did hear it when it came out, and maybe my history is fucked up because that happens a lot when you get to my age. But like,
dude, you're like 2 years older than me.
I love Gwen Stefani. There's certainly an extreme aesthetic appeal to her.
Well, yeah, she's hot.
That would be the aesthetic appeal.
And thank you.
You're welcome.
But I kind of felt like this was coming around the same time that, and maybe again my history, but like Christina Aguilera and Britney Spears were trying to re-kick some really tragic kind of E! Hollywood Story nightmares from their lives.
I think Britney Spears didn't start to fall off the rails to like 07 when she shaved her head.
But I still feel like this was kind of a response to kind of that kickstart, restart deal that was going on with these female pop stars at the time. And Gwen Stefani kind of jumped on that bandwagon. And
about the time she jumped off the No Doubt wagon? Is that what you're saying?
You know,
she was 35. She had been in No Doubt at that point for 18 years.
There was a gap, wasn't there? I mean, this wasn't just like jumping off of the No Doubt bandwagon into this kind of.
She also had her first kid in 05. And I think that was also about. I think that might have had more with her jumping off the No Doubt bandwagon.
I'm not sure what the timeline was.
I'm not sure.
I guess my point being is that I saw this particular single as being more kitsch than anything else.
It's certainly kitschy. But for whatever reason, I just really fucking like it.
It makes me want to burn America to the ground. Start over.
And that is your right to feel.
And my address, for those of you listening, is...
There's a lot shittier music than we just talked about. Nickelback and Creed.
Oh, my God.
There's a lot shittier music. Look, this is a song that I don't like.
And the thing is, all of those people make shit tons of money.
But that's not what the discussion's about. Why don't we go ahead and just listen to a clip of the song?
Okay. Do we have to? Uh-huh, this my shit. All the girls stop to feel like this.
Talking shit, and you didn't think that I would hear it. People hear you talking like that, getting everybody fired up. So I'm ready to attack, gonna lead the fight, gonna get a touchdown, gonna take you out. That's right, put your pom poms down, getting everybody fired up.
That was Holla Back Girl, so I found it on Urban Dictionary, by the way. I was savoring it until after.
We were trying to delve into the depths of.
Oh, no.
The subtext.
There's a lot of depth here. And so, but I'm just going to read this out. So earlier, before I read this definition, let's just go back and remember that basic. What you said a minute ago was that.
A girl was stepping to her.
A girl was stepping to her, and she wasn't going to step back. Okay, so here's what the real definition is. And these are not my words. In order to fully understand what a holla back girl is, one must first understand what it means to holla back. When one hollas back, one responds to a verbal insult with their own reciprocal verbal insult.
Okay.
So, Ryan... You were correct. I wish I had one of those loud
I need
trumpet
gold
sounds.
Star.
Wait. Cafeti coming.
So is she saying she?
She is not a holla back girl.
She is not a holla back because she's rising above. She's
what about rising. The double negative?
Ain't no.
That's so street. If we're gonna call pop writers
double
on,
negatives or street.
Oh no!
I just want to know.
No, ain't no holla back girl. No. Gotcha. Yeah, which means she is a holla back girl.
If we're gonna call pop writers on their
this is so deep
their grammar. We could go way back.
Well, I'm just saying with the mood of the song. Which
I'm not trying to hear that, Shane.
She is not.
It's pretty attitudinal. It's an attitudinal song.
She is not a holla back girl.
Yeah,
it is.
She's trying to say that she's rising above it.
Okay, got
it. She was 35.
By bringing along a marching band to
this, well, it goes on. This goes on saying, The song was a response to a comment Courtney Love made about Gwen in an interview with 17 magazine. That sentence in and of itself
is
fucking brilliant.
Frame that. Put it on the wall.
Love reportedly stated, "Being famous is just like being in high school, but I'm not interested in being the cheerleader. I'm not interested in being Gwen Stefani. She's the cheerleader, and I'm out in the smoker shed." Gwen, upon hearing this, did not holla back like a petty cheerleader. She instead came back with "Holla Back Girl."
With cheerleaders.
Well, with cheerleaders, but...
Well, let's all thank our lucky stars that we did, except for Phil.
I mean, it's a great video to look at, you know.
That description
Great video to look at.
It reminds me of, like, Hard Day's Night, where George Harrison's like, "Oh, that's that posh broad, or posh bird, and we like to mute the television and say rude things about her."
I was just going to say that.
I could do that.
I just watched Hard Day's Night. I wouldn't have even thought of that. It kind of reminds me of, I don't know what. I also just watched
Family Ties.
No, I just watched. No, but that's good. That's good. Yeah. I just watched an episode of In Living Color last night, from 1991, which was
that would be when it was on.
There were fly girls dancing.
They did have fly
Jennifer
girls.
Lopez.
Yeah,
was
Jennifer
one of
Lopez.
Them.
She was.
Yeah. Was a fly girl.
Okay, Ryan. Well, thank you so much. We're going to end this intermission.
My pleasure.
This has been a few minutes with.
Yep. Go back. Let's not pretend that what just happened didn't happen.
Okay.
No, it happened.
I was going to say the elephant in the room because we were going to laugh about it.
Which you've done before, and now Phil has just popped
I had my mic off. Yes.
That's a pretty illustrious group, I must say, though.
Yeah. Are we a club of
You're
two?
You're a good company. We are a club of two.
Yeah, we have one mic here in the garage that has an on-off switch.
Button.
And apparently my friends Phil and Shane both have this propensity to just flick it on and off.
Well, you have a couple drinks and you start messing around with shit. It's like the same thing as people that, you know, you're sitting at a bar and you know.
I'm just in training in case I ever end up with a woman again.
Long and phallic shape you got to start to play with.
Well, for me it's more about the button.
Mark,
I'm just
I do sometimes
no,
pull
you
the
aren't.
Labels off my beard.
No, I'm just aren't. Flicking the button.
Yeah, just oh,
guys.
All right, kids. Let's talk about Sugar Otis. How about that?
Kid is right.
14-year-old.
Who's that?
Sorry to be so down on the Gwen Stefani stuff.
I don't care.
No,
it doesn't diminish my enjoyment of it.
That's cool, and I envy that. I really do.
It's not I guess I just have a weird way of of thinking about it. Like personally, myself, like I said before, many times in the intermission there. Like, I don't like that song, but I still can step outside of it and say, oh, well, that's
this
really
is why people like it.
Yeah, I don't want to listen to it.
Yeah.
The B-A-N-N-A-S shit is it's grating on my nerves, but I find the production to be really interesting in that song. And so that's just a lot of times. Meatloaf was sorry to interrupt you. That's why Meatloaf, it was so egregious to me because I couldn't even find
There's
a way
nothing good about
to
that.
Defend it. It's so bad.
I agree.
I almost want to do another show on Meatloaf. I feel
don't
like
do it.
Oh no,
whole
not,
other
no, I'm not voluntarily listening to any more Meatloaf.
I do have some Meatloaf in the refrigerator now.
That's the.
I would rather listen to that Meatloaf than.
Yeah,
much more inspirational.
Let me put it this way:
I'd rather listen to the sound a fax machine makes when it calls a phone number than.
And I'm a little interested because you're such a good songwriter, and I hold you in high esteem as a songwriter. And I said that the last time, I guess, when you were gone too. I feel insulted when I listen to songs like that. And it doesn't matter if it's like dance pop or Meatloaf or like pop country, you know, stuff like...
That shit's way better than pop country.
It all feels really insulting
to
me.
All subjective.
Yeah.
It feels insulting to me. It feels like they're just like, oh, you know what? We're going to say the most inane shit, and people are going to spend bazillions of dollars on it.
But that's why I think this video in particular, I feel like the production was so interesting. But you know what?
Back to Shuggy.
We talked about that.
Yeah. More to Shuggy.
Yeah, and I mean... There probably is something out there, some music that has been inspired by Gwen Stefani's.
Oh, I'll tell you what it is. It's called Iggy Azalea Fancy. It's the same beat, and it sounds exactly...
Does it have a marching band?
No, but if you listen to the chorus, have you guys not heard... I mean, this is like one of the biggest rap songs in the world the last 2 months.
Like, I didn't know that song until like a couple years ago.
I almost want to turn this off, push pause, and let you guys listen to Fancy.
But will that span 40 years of music? I mean...
Well, I mean, people are still listening to...
Still
people are still listening
people.
To Cherry Baby, and that's fucking equally as shitty, in my opinion. Like... But or like shitty like the Monster Mash or whatever shit. From
right,
the
but nobody's
50s.
Making the Monster Mash part two.
Yeah,
you know what I mean.
Or actually,
are they sampling?
Are they?
They did for many years.
Oh no,
it's been going on.
God damn it, people!
But okay, so
does anybody have anything to say about Shuggy?
I do.
Let's go back and talk
about
Shuggy.
I'm gonna postulate that maybe part of the reason that Shuggy Otis disappeared was A, that he could, son of a famous musician, had put out 3 albums, had a single that had charted over 1 million, you know, with the Brothers Johnson covering it. He was getting his mailbox money, had a kid from his first girlfriend, got married, had a second kid. He and his kid were gigging in his pops' band. You know, he was getting session work as a guitarist, and he didn't have to write. And, you know, maybe it's just like he had
just
put out...
He didn't want the...
Not only that, but like sometimes...
The fame coaster...
Maybe, or maybe he's just like, he was like, oh, I put out this one album and I had this hit and I put out this next album and it kind of tanked. You know, it's a lot of work. I put in three years of my life. I'm 19 now.
David Byrne comes along in 2001?
David Byrne comes along and does Shuggy Otis kind of go, oh, fuck. Now I got to be a musician again.
I don't know.
No, you're getting, at that point, like, we're many,
it's
many
money.
Years
it's
in.
Mailbox
there's
money.
Yeah, and yeah. Also... You know, like there's something to be said for, you know, people don't really get this, but there's something to be said for losing the muse, and it happens to a lot of people. You know, and sometimes a lot of people look in the bright lights and they decide they don't like what they see in the bright lights, and they navigate toward the back
Dude,
of the band.
I think being famous would be fun for about 6 months.
It's not even the being famous part, and it's not even the speculating about being famous. It's about the actuality of the type of ways your life just changes.
Not only that, but like younger people are like really creative. They're less inhibited and they're more creative. You look at like, I don't know, Brian Wilson famously went bonkers. At 22 is when he had his mental breakdown, and Pet Sounds was released when he was 23, and he'd already had 10 number one hits by then. 10!
Yeah.
You know? The Beatles, like, none of them were 30 when,
30
they, broke
when they broke
up.
I think
that's crazy.
Ringo wasn't.
I think Ringo was 31, wasn't he?
Oh, let me think. July 7th, 1940.
Jesus.
No, he was 29 barely.
Okay.
And he was the oldest.
Yes. Okay. So, anyway, move.
But the point is, it's like there's no shortage of young people who like do something amazing and then flame out. You look in acting, a bunch of child stars never make the transition to adulthood. A bunch of young stars don't make the transition into like later adulthood. You know, there's like the arts in general and being creative in general. It's like it's trying to catch lightning in a bottle, but you don't have a lot of like career artists who are consistently making quality products.
I really saw the whole Shuggy Otis thing as being more of this, I need to break out from underneath my father. And
yeah,
here
I can
comes
see that.
Shuggy Otis. You know, it's kind of like this first attempt at I can be my own person apart from my father. And then he gets into this rhythm, and then he kind of strikes it with this album.
Previous album, I think.
Previous album.
Yeah.
And then here he goes, and then all of a sudden, I think that it just kind of peters out for him.
I think we can hear it petering out in the album.
I think so, definitely.
I think I read the I wanted to mention this earlier, but there was a Robert Christgau, the famed... music critic for the Village Voice.
Right.
Who just...
Legend in his own mind.
Agreed.
Yes. Pops up a lot in these podcasts. And I'd like to read his small little blurb. It's actually called Turkey Shoot. And this is from November 20th of 2001.
What is called Turkey Shoot?
His little review thing here. And basically what it is, there are a lot of little... capsule reviews, all of which are not great reviews. That's where I think he's saying, oh, turkey shoot, like they're
gotcha.
All turkeys.
These are turkeys. These are me taking shots at them.
Yeah.
Right.
And by the way, I'm going to read this, but the review right underneath it is Peaches, the Teaches of Peaches, which we did a couple weeks ago. We fucked the paint away.
We did.
Definitely amusing. But that got a higher grade than the Shuggie Otis album.
What?
And that's at that point when you know that Robert Christgau is
full of shit.
Okay, so this is how this is the review for Inspiration Information, the Luwaka Bop re-release. What a waste. With a bigger boost from his hustler bandleader dad, who started recording Johnny Jr. at, by the way, this guy's got a chip on his shoulder about this kid. At Johnny Jr. at 17 and got Al Kooper to produce this lad's first album, this genius in disguise might have become a very successful studio guitarist. You get to keep meeting the stars, and if you're biz savvy, ad work eventually provides a reliable income stream. Instead, Shug merely created what experts from the High Llamas, the fuck is referencing the High Llamas in any way, all the way to Tortoise agree was almost like a new style of music that could have developed but never did. Given his vocal inferiority to Average White Band, that's some lazy criticism. You can't even look up the fucking singer from Average White Band.
Right.
Hall & Oates and the Brothers Johnson, this presumably refers to the funk light fusion experts, again, and from the High Llamas all the way to Tortoise, have taken it upon themselves to defunkify with cultural consequences not yet detectable.
What? I'm sorry, were you still talking?
Yeah. Damning with faint praise.
Yeah. I don't know.
He sounds like a guy, like a happy guy. Want to go have a drink with him?
Yeah.
Chris Gow's one of these critics, I think, that just writes to like impress other critics.
No. He sees himself as the last of a vanguard. I mean, what? He's
like Lester Bangs.
No. He's. I genuinely believe when he gets drunk, like he gets really drunk and like prays to Lester. He's like, I'm still holding the torch for you, Lester.
Do you think Lester appears to him like Obi-Wan Kenobi?
I hope that he appears to him in the guise of Philip Seymour Hoffman.
Well, you brought up Obi-Wan Kenobi, and I've been meaning to mention this. Mark, can you tell us about your blow up doll Christmas decorations in your front yard? You have
I have a 2.5-year-old
Christmas
and an 8-year-old, and yes, Christmas now vomits on my front yard every year. It's something that I am amused with, certainly, but we do have a new addition to this year's festivities. It's on our front porch, and it is a very poor rendition of C-3PO and R2-D2.
I think it's pretty funny.
With Santa caps?
With Santa caps, and R2-D2 is entangled in a faux Christmas string of lights. And the caption, of course, on the whole thing is, "Droids to the world."
Oh,
can we just have a collective groan across the internet right now?
I'll fix that in post.
Oh, Lord.
Yeah. So listen, Phil, like, you like this record a lot.
Let's
do one more clip before we get out of it, because
I think we should stick with like either track 2, because it's got, again, that like kind of that organ beat, or track 3.
The one that I latched onto, I don't remember what it's called, but track 2 is
Island
that I liked.
Yeah, I mean, you know, track 2 I think is pretty good. Island Letter. Sparkle City really kind of shines for me on this.
I think Sparkle City is like a more classic funk jam.
The only thing about that song in particular is, and we talked about this, and I do like the music on that, but
yeah.
I talked about this last with Real Estate a couple weeks ago, is that I absolutely hate instrumentals in the middle of vocal records.
Yeah.
I don't get them. I don't get it. Like, just put some lyrics to your music. But
for me, I'm more interested in all the little like drum loop things that are happening throughout the album, because it's like, to me, that's the stuff that wasn't getting picked up by like Prince and Lenny Kravitz, but was getting picked up by like, you know, Postal Service.
Well, we have been concentrating on the first half of this album.
Yeah.
And then it kind of devolves in the middle here into kind of this weirdness. But that's when he really starts to play more with this electronic drum loops, and
I think maybe that's part of why the album took 3 years. You know, it's like he was 16 when he was 16 when he started, and by the time he was 19, maybe he had already like was like, yeah,
well, that's
I don't have
point,
what it takes,
Mark. I mean, there is like some really innovative stuff going on at the end of the record. I mean, we've been talking about how the better songs on the first half of the record, and I think they are for sure.
They are.
But it does get more experimental as the as it goes on.
That was a little bit of Sparkle City, which Mark brought up the exact point that I was going to bring up. It's a little evocative of Sanford and Son, minus the campiness. Like Sanford and Son, the theme song to Sanford
the
and
theme
Son.
The theme song to Sanford and Son is amazing.
Quincy Jones,
again,
man.
It's that,
it was?
Yeah.
I had that, no idea.
Who produced the Brothers Johnson, and they were the ones who took him Strawberry Letter 23. It all comes full circle.
Amazing.
Shit. If we were doing acid right now, man, I would just have to go sit underneath a car outside or something.
But it's that slap bass and that wah-wah pedal and just total funk jazz.
It's unapologetic. It is what it is. But, you know, it definitely gets the head nod going.
It does.
It moves.
For sure.
Right.
It is enjoyable, but now I'm not going to be able to enjoy it as much as I did before because I'm going to see, like, the big one!
The Elizabeth! I'm coming, Elizabeth! I loved Red Fox.
Oh, R.I.P.
I just saw it. I was watching a thing about Richard Pryor last night, and they were talking about how Eddie Murphy brought, was it Harlem Nights? It was Red Fox, Richard Pryor, and Eddie Murphy, like trying to do like a generational thing, and then they were mentioning like how could you take these three incredibly funny, like
gifted comedians,
gifted
and make
comedians
a shitty
and
movie,
make such a shitty movie.
It happens.
Yes.
Well, but that's a different podcast.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. No, it's not a different podcast. It's this podcast. How long have you been doing this?
Well, so we diverge.
So Shane doesn't really,
he's anti-instrumental.
He made a comment about the instrumental, putting it in the middle of the album like this and breaking it up. But to me, this really is kind of, I mean, you kick off this album and it's strong, and then you get into this song and it's got that funk jazz kind of jive to it. And then Shuggy starts to kind of go off somewhere. And for a few songs, I feel like he's really kind of departed until he kind of brings it back around towards the end of this album.
Yeah, I think, I think the thing to consider is that it took a few years to put the album together. Why did it take so long? And I think maybe he just was like, I just don't have material.
I think that, yeah, he didn't have material. And also, like, shit is changing so quickly in your brain when you're that age.
Uh-huh.
Like, you're getting material, and then, you know, 6 months later, if you go back and look at the Beatles in between, like, 1963
and 65,
and then
Please Me to, like, Rubber Soul. Like,
in the same fucking year. I mean, like, just crazy, crazy stuff.
Right.
You know, stuff changes so, so fast when you're writing a lot, and also you're...
I mean, Please Me to Rubber Soul is like, what, 6 albums in less than 3 years?
In less than three years.
That's insane.
Yeah.
The first 4 albums were 20 months.
Dude, 3 years ago feels like yesterday to me.
But the first 3 albums, I mean, we're talking
about
the
Beatles. They were covering
a
lot of stuff.
Well,
half.
But also
only
even
half.
The stuff that they...
And at a time when everybody was covering 100%.
Even the stuff when they... were writing. There's such a uniformity in their songs that really only starts getting broken up at Hard Day's Night, I feel like. There are great songs before that, but you see stylistic changes in A Hard Day's Night. And then after
which is their first album that was all originals. So, yeah. And their third album.
Then you're off to the races.
Yeah. So we can draw some similarities here in this kind of evolution of the way that you write music over time. And I mean,
and as the provenance of youth too, I think.
Yeah, I think that was as the provenance of youth. I mean, that's a great way of putting it.
So is there a maturing process in this album?
I think some of the songs on this album are some of his finest examples of songwriting in a career that is unfortunately a little short,
and quite truncated.
And you're a pop songwriter. Actually,
yeah.
Two of the four of us here are pop songwriters.
Right. Although I did play in Liquid Soul for a long time, so like I can play a funk jam. You know, I can do it. Don't make me. I mean, I will for money.
And I was part of a Christian pause. Pop band, so yeah.
But yeah, I mean, like, I love 70s funk, and to me, like, the thing I love about 70s funk and 70s power pop is that if you listen to them, a lot of people are like, oh, I love funk, it's so happy sounding, or like, I love pop songs, there's, you know, 70s power pop, it's so happy sounding. And then you listen to both of them, and they're like, lyrically, they're quite sad. That's what they have in common. You know, it's like with funk, there's a lot of this like, well, I gotta dance or I gotta laugh about it or it's just so sad, I'll just fucking die.
Yeah, that's a really interesting way to look at it.
And those are the two kinds of music that appeal to me the most. So,
to me, I'll stand by this. Like, enjoyable record.
Yes. Essential? I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know about essential, but I can definitely see where it has been a touchstone for some artists.
And I think that is maybe what makes it essential. Is it's not essential to us, but I think it is essential to the music that we have enjoyed.
Yeah. Clearly, a lot of people whose music we do enjoy have enjoyed him first.
I mean, my first impression of it, and don't judge me, Mom, if you're listening to this, but was like, wow, this sounds like the soundtrack to the first porn I ever watched. I mean, it just does.
You know? Oh, is that what porn sounds like?
Of wah-wah.
Why were you watching porn in the 70s is what I want to know, number one.
I wasn't watching porn in the 70s, but the first porn
six-year-old Ryan Newsom.
Was from the 70s?
Was from the 70s.
Was it like, okay, because I know that when I was a kid, like, one of us, and I know that this happened to many, many different groups.
I had a VCR.
No, but hold on. So, like, somebody's got a hold of somebody's dad's Playboy, and then it got buried in
the
woods.
It was my friend's older brother, like much older brother.
Well, hold on. So my friends would get a hold of somebody else's dad's Playboys, and then they would get buried in the woods, and then over the course of time, holes would develop in the Playboys.
And everybody knew where to go.
Put them in plastic shopping bags or something?
No, we didn't think about that. But so what I'm wondering is,
why are these pages stuck together?
There were no pages stuck together back then.
I do remember.
Remember eight.
The kid
there was
no named
ability to stick
Phillip.
Pages together.
But I don't remember his last name, and he had an older brother who was like 8 years older than us, and I was like 13 or 14 or something, and he supplied us with like my first actual porn.
Did you go buried in the woods and did holes get
well?
Eaten
no, like that.
The
that
tape?
Happened with well, I found porn like Playboys and penthouses and whatnot that we all through the underground network of like horny pre-adolescents. Knew where to find it.
You don't find that. You don't find that in your Texas history textbook.
Not typically.
The band of 40 adolescents. Yeah. Pre-adolescents. It's always pre-adolescents.
The porn underground.
It was a porn underground. Like we all knew where it was, and I knew whose dad had a stash somewhere. And anyhow, my point was, this record reminds me of the first 70s porn music I heard. And it's better than that.
It is.
For sure. You know, and like I said, I'll go back to what I said earlier. Bill Withers.
Yeah, good call.
More horny, I said, with a stiffy. Meets James Brown on Quaaludes with a dash of Sly and the Family Stone. And I stand behind that.
Yeah, I would definitely agree with the Sly and the Family Stone.
Maybe that's actually really realistic. I mean, you think about porn music and, like, where is that inspiration from? And, I mean, this, you know, Shuggie is somebody who was really...
I think he was influential at the time, sure.
I think it was more influential, not at that moment, but a year or two later, and then as it went on and on and on into the 80s.
Well, that's a thing that happened. You know, like Velvet Underground was a thing that, you know, they thought they were done, and like
Velvet Underground,
their legend grew.
When I was listening to this record, actually, that was one of, even though they sound nothing alike, it's just one of those touchstones that I considered, I thought about. Like, oh, yeah, like this kind of reminds me of the Velvet Underground.
The way that legend developed. You know.
Yeah, if you listen to Steely Dan, that shitty ass fucking music, and there's so much this is that's cribbed from this, but this shit is so much more interesting now. Like the whole, like it started to, because I hate Steely Dan so goddamn much. It started.
I do less, but
they're your Gwen Stefani.
What's that?
They're your Gwen Stefani.
No. Like
his white whale.
Hey, let's get out of here. What are we doing? So, Mark, do you know what we're doing next week? It's your week to pick.
At this moment, it's a secret.
Okay.
I don't know that album.
Yeah.
All right.
Secret.
And then it's my week to pick a few minutes with, and I picked Put Your Records On by Corinne Bailey Ray.
I don't know that song at
She's
all.
She's got a really Good. Great voice.
Yeah, you do.
Well, we'll listen to the song. We'll see how we feel about that.
Thanks so much for joining us.
Yes.
Thanks for having me. I really enjoyed it.
Yeah, yeah.
What has this been?
Again?
What?
Somebody Likes It with Shane.
And Ryan.
And Phil.
And Mark.
Yeah. Hey.
It's like some sort of skit in the electric company. That's my friend Ryan.
We're going now.
All right, bye.
Bye.